Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PO Marketing Network Lead customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's a Saturday night. It's 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. Every Saturday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 on the Central side, we do Scott Johnson's radio show. This is actually Scott Johnson's show. We've been doing this for lots and lots and lots of years, ever since, probably around that Herbalife and Vima challenges with the FTC. Well, tonight we have a returning guest. And I'm going to keep my introduction super duper short because we want to give him as much time as he truly deserves for being here as a return guest over here. We've had him maybe 3, 4, 5 times, something like that, but it's always very interesting information, and I enjoy listening to his comments and going back and forth with him and Scott Johnson a lot. So Scott's got his own website. He's going to tell you a little bit about that. But if you go to buildingfortunesradio.com/Scott-Johnson, you'll be able to hear the previous radio shows that we've done. So we finished up with last week. We had the solar events, and many of you have made it through that. Unfortunately, there are some people in Houston that are probably not able to listen to us live at this time because there was some tornadoes and some horrific storms, and I'm wondering, why couldn't they just turn those windmills around, you know, saving the climate? Turn those windmills the right way so you can, you know, get extra electricity, but for whatever reason, they fall down in high winds and hurricanes, which is kind of interesting for climate control or climate change. We could talk about that some other time, but Scott Johnson, thanks for being here on your own radio show.
Hey, Peter, thanks for having me. Yeah, they have a lot of flooding problems down there. In fact, there's flooding all over East and Central Texas. It's been just an incredible spring as far as the repeated heavy rains. It's the soil is completely saturated, and we typically have clay soil. So once it gets saturated, it's not like Florida where it's sandy, where it just sinks in through the ground. It lays on top of the ground. It's been a mess. Me personally, you know, we're okay. We're kind of on some high ground, so not a big deal. But yeah, there's a lot of issues. I would say in the, you know, eastern one third of Texas. Now we don't complain about it because it's going to get hot and dry pretty soon. So we have to be thankful for the rain when we get it. Sometimes it's just more than we need it at one time. So, but anyway, we do have a great guest back. I think he was here 2 or 3 weeks ago, something like that. And we didn't get to talk about the one thing that I really wanted to talk about, so we're going to do that tonight because we had some other good discussions about other things. But at the beginning of the show, we like to go over the basics, right? So if you're a new listener, you can understand where we're coming from and why we say the things that we say. And so from my perspective, I think there's 2 major problems with MLMs. And I'm for MLM when it's done right. I'm against MLM when it's done wrong, and I pick these 2 big things, not because there's nothing else wrong with MLM, but these are the 2 big things. You could fix everything else other than these 2 things, and you would have made very little progress. But if you fix these 2 things, all the little things really are little in comparison. And I always like to say there's no business that's perfect, whether it's an MLM or a non-MLM business, because humans are involved, and humans are not perfect. So we're not going for perfection here. We're going for, okay, what's the big ticket items? So the big ticket items, number one, is pretty much universal. There could be an exception here and there. I haven't found it conclusively, but that is the lack of retail sales. And when we say retail sales, we're talking about people who are customers. You know, they're not your downline. They're not distributors. They're people who are not involved in the MLM compensation plan. They're customers. And there's very little of that going on in most and perhaps all MLMs. And that's what makes an MLM an illegal pyramid, is the lack of retail sales, even though the FTC and we'll talk about that a little bit more, didn't really reject that theory, but they also refused to be more specific, and we'll get into that in a few minutes. The other big problem, which is not universal amongst MLMs, but it is definitely with Amway, and I was at Amway several years. I know all about this. And some others, Herbalife is one. There's probably some others out there. It's hard to even find these tool scams because they're kind of under the radar. So I'm sure there's others. I just couldn't name you any particular companies. I do know there are some companies that prohibit tool scams, and they've even kicked people out of the MLM even for very minor infractions. So it's definitely not as universal as lack of retail sales. So when we talk about tool scams, and particularly in Amway, it's the upper-level distributors. They call them IBOs now, independent business owners. The top people have these tools that they sell to their downline with the idea that they're going to train and motivate them. And by the way, I don't have a big issue with the content. Not that I agree with everything that has ever been put in the tool, but I'm sure there's not a human being on the planet that I agree with everything. So, you know, I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill in that regard. And so when we say tools, what they are is, back in Peter and my day, it was books, tapes, and functions. They still sell books. Instead of cassette tapes, they sell MP3 and MP4 electronic downloads, essentially. And also, there's various meetings, functions is what they call them, and they're all different sizes for different purposes throughout the year. Typically, there's at least a dozen, maybe two dozen of these meetings of different types, depending on your line of sponsorship. And they make a lot of money at all of these things, plus things like phone apps, website access, voicemail. It's very lucrative. And what you'll find on my websites are some examples of people that got kicked out, and then they started talking. And typically, they weren't trying to brag about how much money they were making from the tools. Typically, they were talking about the new MLM they joined, and these are my words, now I don't have to scam my downline with tools anymore because I'm in this new MLM that pays better. That's usually sort of the framework of their comments. But in doing so, they do talk about how much money is being made in the tools. And my favorite example is a guy that got kicked out, I think, in the early 2000s. His name is Brig Hart, and it's B-R-I-G-H-A-R-T. And he gave a interview to a Salt Lake City media outlet, and he said, oh, yeah, I was making almost $1 million a year from Amway before I got kicked out, and I was making $8 to $10 million a year from the tools. So we're talking 10 times plus in that example. There's other examples, and I have several of them on my website that talk about twice as much, 4 to 5 times as much. You know, it's all these numbers, but even at twice as much, think about it, that's 2/3 of your income, even at twice as much being made from tools compared to Amway. So now what makes it a scam isn't that they're making the money. That's, to me, that's not a problem, making money. But what they do is they lie by omission. They leave out the fact that that is where they make most of their money while they're in. When they get out, sometimes they squeal, but while they're in, you know, it's zip the lips. Nobody knows unless they check out the internet and so forth, which I think has helped, the internet. But you won't hear it from your upline while you're in Amway because they obviously don't want to talk about it. Neither does Amway. Amway does not want to talk about it either. But it's a fact. And so that's what makes it the scam, is they give every impression that they make their lifestyle from Amway, but they make most of their lifestyle from the tools. So I just want to make that to be clear. Now, I think that's RICO fraud, and I'm not a lawyer, but it's at least business fraud, because if you misrepresent the business model to someone that you're essentially saying, hey, I'd like to go into business with you, and you leave out where you're making most of your money from, to me, that's a clear case of fraud. To use the FTC's lingo, unfair and deceptive business practice. I cannot think of anything more unfair and deceptive than what I just described in the tool scam. So that's something we're still waiting for the FTC to wake up to. So that's the two big ones. And Peter, I see some really good-looking legs there on SlaglerBeach.tv. Are you adjusting the camera?
I'm doing something outside waiting for my dog. Waiting for the dog. Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. It's just fine. Yeah, if you go to SlaglerBeach.tv, it's a live 24/7 camera, and go to where it says Critter Cam, and you'll see Peter's legs from the knees down. So, good deal. It was either you or a really big deer.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, that's what I'm trying to protect my flowers from.
I know. There's an ongoing battle with Peter and his deer. You're the one that feeds them corn. You're the one that accidentally drops the corn in the backyard every day. So.
Yep. A little bit like Bill Murray and that little gopher.
That's right. Exactly right. Yep. So anyway, we digress. I just had to make a comment. We do have Dave Vaughn back again. And Dave, if you could just spend a minute or two, again, for the new listeners, kind of where you got involved with MLM, not directly. I know that you were never in an MLM, but how you got involved in the subject matter. And then we can get into this week's discussion.
Sure. Thank you, Scott and Peter, for inviting me back on again. I started Scott and Peter started way before me, but I was introduced to MLM, I guess proper, in 2018 here in Taiwan. I was hanging out with a friend, and he got involved in a company known as Market America here. For most people in Taiwan, it's known as shop.com, or they also go by their Chinese name of Mei An. I was introduced first to it through a video, as is typically done. It was the English video, and I just had some questions about it. I had taken economics before, the whole prospect of game theory, and this notion of inviting a bunch of people into a program in order to participate in a reward system by purchasing a product. It seemed interesting to me, but I also sort of saw some of the areas for exploitation and vulnerability. So I dug into it a little bit more. Actually, that same year, I think Jane Marie released the first season of her podcast, The Dream. I went on a deep dive into some of the other materials that were released regarding MLMs and the concerns there, and really tried to digest my concern with it. I had actually sort of started with the hypothesis that, like, how could I take advantage of the system to support the people here in Taiwan, knowing that a lot of the system would accrue to the upline? Or was there a better way to run MLM in the sense of, like, installing solar panel roofs on people's houses in impoverished areas and having them recruit downlines into the energy system so they would benefit from the people that they had recruited, so it would sort of reverse the kind of cycle of poverty that they were stuck in. But I could never really figure out the way to do so without leading to a tremendous system of growth and eventual false promises that couldn't materialize for most of the people that will get involved, because the incentive would always be more around recruitment as opposed to just sales of the product that was looking to be used in that model. So I ended up releasing a few articles about sort of what I was looking at and some basic models just from my rudimentary understanding of economics. And I was in touch with people like Ethan Vanderbilt at the time, some individuals from the Anti-MLM Coalition I was in regular contact with. This was in 2019, 2020. Then, of course, the pandemic happened, and Anti-MLM blew up on the internet in terms of the social media space, and a lot of temporary creators were creating content in there, and then some have stayed and become more permanent. And I've just been sort of involved in the sort of background of a lot of the stuff, never creating my own videos, but just looking to support people that are trying to investigate the questions of MLM and just go through some of the data. I have done some public reports of some companies that release their data, so a lot of the publicly traded MLMs are ones that I've dug into in terms of the numbers that are there, and just trying to see what can be understood about the macro level of data, because unfortunately there's not a lot that you can draw as conclusions. You can draw a lot of assumptions on that macro level data, but the system itself seems to be interesting to study. So it sort of drawn me into this world and has become a bit of a hobby for me to look at a little bit more closely.
All right. Yeah, very good. Yeah, and Market America and Shop.com in particular used to be a Amway partner store. They no longer are. I don't know exactly when they were dropped, but that would have been back in the, very late 1990s through somewhere in the 2000s. I certainly don't know when they stopped being a partner store. And also the founder of Market America is kind of famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, from the John Oliver MLM video, which I recommend people watch. If you go on YouTube, if you just do a search for John Oliver MLM, I think it's the fourth or fifth most viewed of his videos. It was somewhere north of, I think, 34 million views. And even though it was about 8 years ago that it was made, it's still current as far as the applicability. Unfortunately, John did not cover my favorite topic, which is tool scams. But most people don't. Most people just don't. They're not aware of it. They don't understand the significance of it when it is present. Because again, that's not something that's universal in MLMs. But the lack of retail sales is, and it's primarily because the prices are pretty high usually, and it's really hard to find customers because of that. Now, in Amway, there's a double dip region because customers don't buy tools, right? There's no reason for them to learn how the business works or be motivated or anything like that because they're just a customer. And so it makes more sense for the upline to promote recruiting new people versus finding customers for that reason as well, because they make a lot more money when their downline recruits a new distributor because they end up buying tools versus the customer that buys a product and they might make some pennies versus dollars. So, there's a double whammy there when there's a tool scam present. But even if there's no tool scam, the high prices really make it difficult to sell products. And therefore, the MLM turns out to be an illegal pyramid. And I'm not really too concerned what the FTC thinks about that. I hope they change their mind, which I'm sure is going to be a major challenge. But when you were here 2 or 3 weeks ago, Dave, we were just about to talk before we ran out of time about the letter that the FTC sent to the DSA this past March 15th, the Ides of March. And the main topic that I thought was interesting was that the FTC refuted what the DSA was putting out as far as retail sales. The DSA essentially said you need to have at least 50% of your products or services going to customers versus distributors in order to not be an illegal pyramid, which has been my mantra for years. And it's actually consistent with the settlements of Vima and Herbalife, both which have happened in 2016. And in Vima, the requirement was to have at least 51% retail sales. And Herbalife is a little more complicated. There's like a one-third to two-third sliding scale. But if you take the middle of that, it's 50%. And so I think that's a very good guideline. It's based on these two settlements, which by definition, were changes that were acceptable to both the two MLMs and the FTC. And so what the FTC responded to when they saw this, at least half, of the products or services going to customers, they said there is no percentage. And I think they missed a really good opportunity to say, that's a really good starting place. That's not the end goal. That's not the end of the answer, so to speak, but it's a really good start. And they did not do that. They simply rejected it and said, there is no percentage. And they just left it hanging. And in my opinion, that's very poor regulation, because if you just refute what somebody says and you don't explain anything more other than it's really complicated and so there's no percentage, then you really haven't done your job as a regulator. You have not given clear guidance to the market, whether it's to the MLM companies or the distributors or the prospects out there. You've just given no information for what someone should be looking for when they're looking at an MLM. And I think that's just really bad regulation. So that's my opinion, Dave. I'll let you, agree or disagree, whatever your thinking is, but that's kind of where I'm coming from on the retail sales angle. I'll let you speak your mind a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have tried to think about the problem as well, because I think there's multiple factors that are fitting into it. I think that you're right. I think the market needs clear guidance in terms of what it's trying to do. And I know right before the MLM conference started, the FTC released their business guidance on MLM, or they revised the guidance. I think previously there were 18 points of guidance that they were offering MLM businesses, and they expanded that to 33. Points of guidance that they're offering. Again, those are not rules per se. They're just opinions of the FTC staff on how they're interpreting the laws of the marketplace. I don't know if I'm phrasing that correctly or not, but it seems to be a very sort of like gentle nudge in terms of the right direction for MLMs, for how the FTC does their operations. But in there as well, they have removed sort of any indication of there being some sort of set percentage, and has stood their ground in terms of believing that no company can be immune on the basis of what percentage of sales they have, which I think that you also agree with, Scott, is that it wouldn't necessarily give them immunity by having 50% or more retail sales, but they are essentially saying there is no magic number. I think by my reading, because they're not just dealing with common highly consumable retail products. In markets like insurance or telephone services, energy, I assume those marketplaces would have different numbers or percentages in order to constitute retail or the existence of a free market for their products. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I understand what you're saying as far as there are certain types of products and services where a different ratio might be more appropriate. However, I think it would be good to start with that and see what happens, because you have to start somewhere. And the reason that I think 50% is a good number to start with, not only is those settlements I mentioned, but also what you're really trying to prove, and this is my theory. When I say theory, I'm not saying this is my guess. Okay, when I say theory, I'm using the word more in line of a scientific theory. You know, in other words, there's a thought, there's a hypothesis, and then you test that hypothesis, you know, over and over again in different situations, and then you come up with a theory. You know, there's a theory of relativity, for example. In fact, I just saw an article earlier today that Albert Einstein's relativity theory has gained more relevance from the standpoint that he predicted, and I won't get into the details because I don't know him anyway, but he predicted certain aspects of black holes and on the edges of the black holes. And it was just a prediction, but there was so many other things you know, that have been proven with his theories, that the expectation was that this part would also be consistent with his theory of relativity, and it is. And so it was just one more, you know, bit of evidence that, yeah, he was on the right track. He definitely had a good theory, because it's been proven in the different, you know, all different kinds of situations and scenarios and so forth. So that's where I come from when I say theory, is you want to have free market demand for the products, and you cannot get that from distributors, because my one line sentence of an MLM is, if you work hard enough and long enough, you'll get filthy rich. And so distributors, I won't say they don't care at all, because I had to bite my lip every time I bought an Amway product that was so overpriced. But distributors are willing to overpay for products because they're being told that. They're being told, I got to where I got by buying the products and buying the tools. If that's where you want to get, that's what you got to do. You got to do what I did to get to where I am. And so it's a very easy story to tell. And it's a very easy way to get people to buy overpriced products. But a customer does not have that in their situation, right? They're not looking to make money. They're just looking at the product, and is it worth the money that's being asked for the product? And again, because most MLM products are overpriced, the answer is usually no, unless it's what I call a sympathy sale, right? I mean, my mom used to buy some skincare from me, not because she loved it, but because she loved me. You know, I was her son. She wanted to support me and my business. So, you know, those are the kinds of sales that you normally get, is the sympathy sales. And while technically they still count, because I don't want to get into the whole argument of, like some people do, well, you know, if it's a relative or friend, it shouldn't count. Well, where do you draw the line? You know, does it have to be like your immediate family? How about a second cousin? How about a friend that you used to have in high school that moved away? You know, where do you draw that line? And I say, don't draw the line. Just it has to be a non-distributor, right? Someone who's not signed the distributor contract. That's what qualifies them to be a customer, because there aren't enough sympathy sales to get enough retail sales for most people. Now, some people know a lot of people. They have a lot of relatives. I'm sure there's a very small percentage that can get their retail sales, but by and large, most people cannot, and therefore the MLM will not be able to do 50% overall. You know, there will be some individuals, but overall the MLM will not come anywhere near 50%. And so that's why I support the 50%. And it can be changed. I know the FTC in the past has said, well, you know, we don't want to get pinned down. And they don't have to pin themselves down. You know, these are lawyers. These are silver-tongued devils, as they call them. You know, they know how to word things. They could easily say, this is a guideline, or this is a minimum, or this is, you know, one of many variables. But at least throw a bone out there to the DSA, which, by the way, I don't respect, but at least give them something that they can show that they're at least trying, not very hard, I might say, but at least they're, you know, giving some kind of indication that they get it. Now, I don't know if the DSA or the FTC understands that you need that free market demand. Otherwise, you have an illegal pyramid. And the way I illustrate that is, let's say a store out there is selling something for $100, just to pick a number, and then an MLM comes along with a similar product, and it's $200. Well, the way I look at it is, the first $100 is just like if you had bought it at a store, whether it's brick and mortar or online. But the second $200 is the premium you're paying, and that premium is just like the old-fashioned airplane game or chain letters or the more modern gifting schemes that are going around where there's no products. All you're doing essentially is, and you can look this up on Google if you want to look up these terms, airplane game, chain letter, and gifting schemes. So there's no products or services. All you do is you pay money to somebody, and then you find, let's say, four other people that are willing to pay you that money, and you move up the ladder, when you get to a certain point with enough people under you, you cash out. But that's what that second $100 is, just like one of those schemes with no products. And so, you know, there's an old adage, how much is something worth? And the answer is as much as someone's willing to pay for it. And I believe in that. I don't care what you're charging, but if you're not getting people to buy it, you know, people that don't have another interest in buying it, like a distributor does, then it's not worth that much by definition. So that's where I'm coming from, Dave, as far as the 50%. I just think we need some clarity, and I'll let you make some comments. Or Peter, if you're there, if you'd like to make a comment, go right ahead.
Let Dave go first. Go ahead, Dave.
Sure. The other part of what I was thinking, and it kind of goes on with what you were mentioning, Scott, is if you look at the Neora case, which I think is what motivated a lot of this new guidance coming out, is the FTC realizing that in order for us to tighten up our cases and be able to approach future companies that we go after with this type of case, we need to make sure that the marketplace is more clarified in terms of where the FTC stands on these issues. And with coming out about a 50% rule, it's only going to create a solution in the marketplace that justifies a 50% within the company, so by their own standards or their own metrics. So what you saw happening in Neora was the 2-month preferred customer anomaly on average. So why were these preferred customers staying in the program for 2 months and then some of them were becoming distributors? I mean, you can kind of look at it as if you imagine the scheme is operating in the sense of you have a new distributor who signs up and they have to recruit 2 new preferred customers before they can realize the material gains of the product and or the scheme being able to reward from the structure or bonus structure of the rewards. And then once those preferred customers are in a position where they have people under them, then they can enroll as a distributor and you maintain that kind of 50% customer rule, but it's on the promise of being offered a distributorship in the future. I don't know for sure if that's what happened in the case of New York, but you can imagine in a marketplace where the incentives would exist to just have at least what you're buying, someone else is buying as well outside the market chain, to be an issue that wouldn't necessarily solve the problems that you're seeing in MLM. It's simply just responding to a market condition set by the FTC.
Yeah, that's,
I don't know if that.
Yeah, you know, that's something I've been talking about for years as far as the UK, because when the UK tried to kick Amway out of the country, the UK regulators, that is, back in 2006, 2007, one of the things that Amway agreed to, and they agreed to everything, my understanding, that the regulator asked for. And that's why the judge allowed them to stay open in the UK. He said, you guys, these are my words, you guys have bent over backwards to every demand that the regulator has demanded from you. And for that reason, even though you've been screwing up, by a very fine margin, just barely, I'm going to let you stay in the country. And one of the things that Amway agreed to is before you could recruit anybody, you had to have a certain amount of retail sales. It was on the order of, I think, $300 US. And I think exactly what you're describing, Dave, has been going on over in the UK for that time period. They tell people, look, just buy as a customer, and then when your sponsor gets enough retail sales, you know, then you can sign up under them and then you can do the same thing, you know. And I found that very suspicious. And we talked about this on the show before because we spent a lot of time on Neora. We had 2 whole shows just talking about the Neora decision. It was very suspicious to me as part of the decision. I don't know if the FTC was suspicious of this. I think not, is that 30%, almost one-third of new Neora distributors come from being a preferred customer. That is unbelievably high. I think in most other MLMs, certainly in Amway, my experience in talking to lots of people over the years, it's less than 1%. very, very few people who are customers, even preferred customers, end up being distributors. And I think that's going on. Either they're telling them explicitly, or they're just not telling them. In the case of Neora, one of the things with Neora, again, I think the FTC blew this, is that when you become a distributor, you get an even deeper discount than if you were a preferred customer. And so it might be that the Neora distributors are being told, now get a preferred customer and don't tell them that there's a deeper discount as a distributor for a month or two. And then tell them, and then they'll become a distributor. I think that's another, tactic that they might be using. But that 30%, when I read it, that was a big alarm in my mind. And I don't know if any of the FTC so-called experts that they hired, or even internally, that was a major warning sign that something is going on here that is not normal. And it was, in fact, in the United States, that's now a rule just starting this year. Just like the UK, you have to have about $300 worth of sales to customers before you can recruit somebody in Amway in the United States. I don't know about other countries, but that's basically the UK rule imported into the United States. So I don't know if that's something they took the initiative on. They were reading the tea leaves, or the FTC is, talking in their ear. But it was a big change. And as well, another big change, again, in the United States, and this is also in the UK, and it has been for almost 20 years now. It's amazing how time flies and you're having fun, is that there's no sign-up fee or renewal fee in the UK. In the United States, there's no sign-up fee, but it's only for the first year. After the first year, then you have to pay the renewal fee, at least so far. I mean, they might expand it because this is the first year. But that's another, major change that Amway made. And when I look at the Costcott standard and how the FTC leans on that, and to me it's the single worst MLM to base all of your cases on, because Costcott was the worst MLM ever as far as how they behaved, because for about a year they didn't have any products, and then when they did have products, they were in very short supply because they were all based on mink oil, and mink oil, they didn't know it doesn't grow on trees, and so they had problems just supplying, the product. Whether it was not available at all or it was in short supply even after it was available. And so it was such an extreme case, and it was a very early case too, right? We're talking mid-1970s, that there wasn't all this history that had been developed over the years. And so the judge was looking at it through that little prism of that extreme situation, and now the FTC tries to use that as their standard bearer, and they really should not be, because again, the judge had no knowledge of the future, and all he had of this extremely poor performing MLM. They were charging, if you wanted to get the deepest discount, you didn't have to pay this, but if you wanted the deepest discount, then you had to pay $5,000, which is in today's dollars about $30,000, okay, just to join. Can you imagine paying $30,000 to an MLM? Now, $30,000 is not a whole lot of money when you compare it to starting a traditional business, especially if it's brick and mortar. But for an MLM, it's way out there. But that's what the whole Costcott standard is based on. When you read the Costcott standard, read it with that in mind, that those were the facts of that case. And there were no other future facts known because the future hadn't occurred yet. And that's why I say the Costcott standard, I wouldn't say it needs to be thrown away completely, but it needs to be revised. It needs to have the experience of the previous, five decades, half century, added on to it, and particularly the retail sales. That's the main thing that the Costcott standard really didn't address, because there was nothing to retail. You know, it really wasn't even a topic. Now, I did do a word search on the Costcott decision, and I think it was 80-something instances of the word retail, and there was one instance of the favorite word that everyone likes to hang on, which is end user. There's only one instance of that in the entire decision, and there's been a lot of discussion over the years, what is an end user? And I know that the pro-MLM people like to say it's anybody, whether it's a distributor or a customer, because they're the end user, literally, of the product or service. Whereas the FTC, and I agree with the FTC on this, is that the end user is really meant to be the customer. The distributors are internal consumption. They're not customers. They're not retail sales. They're internal consumption. And you have to separate that buying from customers buying. So anyway, that was a very long-winded. I put a lot of stuff in there, I know. And I have even more to say, but I'll stop there and let Dave or Peter, you know, agree or disagree or add on or whatever you'd like to do. But that's kind of where I'm coming from, you know, from a number of different areas there. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Peter, do you mind weighing in on just the 50%?
Sure.
Why do you think the FTC went that direction with removing that kind of belief in the market?
I think it really boils down to where this whole thing starts. So, little history lesson. In the United States, we have three branches of government. We have the legislative, we have the executive, and then we have the judicial. The executive guys make the law. The executive people, they carry out the law, and then the judicial people kind of evaluate the laws. Now, the FTC is an independent agency. It's not part of the executive, the legislative, or the judicial branches. So, in essence, they can only give guidance because they can't make laws. And I think if they set a specific number, they would be more like making a law, and that's really what the executives is supposed to do, or the legislative, rather, is supposed to do. So part of the challenge is, I'm going to use a bad analogy. I'm trying to think of one while we were talking, but we have like three guys on the phone right now. There's, you know, Peter, Scott, and Dave. So imagine, you know, there was a fourth guy that just shows up, and he's got punishment power, and he's got all kinds of power, closing people down if they're a listener coming in. And imagine if that's the guy who could, I'm going to make him a guy in this example, that fourth player was not elected, and he's not part of any, he doesn't answer to us. He just kind of does his own thing, but he controls maybe who can get in on the radio show, who can listen on the radio show, who gets punished by being on the radio show. And you'd say, well, that's kind of messed up. Like, how did we ever set anything like that up? And then we're looking for some level of clarity. So in my opinion, the FTC is always walking that line, whereas like they're just like everybody else in the government, they're money hungry, they're power hungry, they're control freaks. I'm saying this playfully, but also sincerely. We put them in the position where they're supposed to be able to do what? Handle, you know, deceptive trade and deceptive practices and protect consumers, and that's what they're supposed to be doing. And I think everybody in the MLM world, using this example, is looking for a number. Why can't you just give me a friggin' number so we can work on this? And the answer is they want to be as specifically vague as they can, because this way they can use it on a case-by-case basis. And they don't even want to explain that to us, which is as frustrating as it gets. So back to one of the earlier comments, we were talking about 50%. We could see how maybe 50% works on this niche, but maybe not in this one, and that would be reasonable. And then maybe it would work on that niche, but maybe not on this one, because that would be unreasonable. And the FTC knows this as well. Why don't they just come out and say that? Well, it's because they don't make the laws. So there was one gentleman at the MLM conference, and I forget his name. He was, Scott, I don't know if you remember his name, Jonas, I think. Justin, I don't remember. But he
Jason
was the
Jones.
One who... Jason Jones, there you go, thank you. So Jason Jones probably said it best to everyone that wasn't listening. Listen, you guys can talk amongst yourself and hold as many of these little conferences as you want, but until you change the laws, nothing's going to change. So that's my answer, Dave, to some of this. So not a perfect answer, but I think a pretty realistic answer on why the FTC stays specifically vague. They don't make the laws. So back to you.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right. At the end of the day, the FTC is in a position where they're an agency. They are simply there to help, not even police the market, because they don't have the ability really to put anyone in jail. They're just simply there to bring forward cases to the judicial side of things and have them evaluate whether or not this is true. And they're representing consumers on that basis. But again, the FTC is not, I think they use the term beat cop in the MLM conference. And I don't even know if they technically qualify as that. They're simply just observing the issues that take place and make note of them. So,
yeah, it's
did you want to get into more?
It's something that a previous president has nominated people to be like security guards, and we don't know anything about their qualifications or whatever as far as them being like security guards. And we don't even know what kind of training they might have been through, what their attitudes were, or if they've ever run a business before. So it's pretty amazing how – I think there was a congressional hearing where one of the gals even said to one of the gals, have you ever run a business before? And she was an academic, and there's nothing wrong with being an academic. They certainly have their places. But the reality was is that she never ran a business before, and at the congressional hearing, she couldn't even say that. So she was dancing around a whole bunch of other issues. But the reality is that if you have people that have never run business before, regulate people that are running businesses, there might be some challenges. So back to you guys.
Scott, in the letter as well, so in addition to the 50%, they also sort of outlined some of the guidance regarding earnings and lifestyle claims for MLMs to follow. That seems to also clarify more of that guidance. You also saw in the business guidance that the FTC released shortly after that matters related to just whether or not compliance departments would be good enough, which to me speaks directly to the Niora decision and wanting to make sure that that whole discussion that the judge was having and favoring in Niora's case, the fact that they did anything for compliance was a signal that they were trying to do their best to mitigate the issues that were seen in the marketplace, and also losing that whole basis of, I imagine what the FTC did is collect information on what the brand partners were doing within Niora in the marketplace to sort of present to the case and show how this manipulation was happening within the marketplace regarding income and deceptive claims. Is there any commentary on that, or do you think that that is just sort of the FTC simply? My whole concern in this matter is that the FTC seems to be really inflating a lot of its guidance that it had before, which is pressing against the DSA, which to my understanding, the FTC didn't really stand in the way of so much before, but it seems like with the past 6 months, they're really trying to sort of impede or intrude on the space that the DSA was occupying in terms of we're self-regulators, we're policing the marketplace, we're doing a good job here. And the FTC was kind of like, yeah, you do your thing and we'll appear and we'll talk at your conferences, sort of adjusted slightly, but we won't really stand in the way of it. But it seems like the past 6 months, the FTC is really trying to get involved in that space.
Yeah, I think the FTC does not see the DSAs being very effective, nor the DSR DSSRC, whatever it's called, that independent, you know, oversight organization. But another really major thing with the Niora case is Niora got really lucky with their timing. And what I mean by that is when the FTC first sued them, it was prior to the 9-0 Supreme Court decision, where the Supreme Court told the FTC, you've been overstepping your bounds for literally 40 years. For four decades, you've been taking this Section 13B part of the law, and you've been overstepping what it allows you to do. What it allows you to do is an injunction. And what an injunction is when you go to a judge and you say, judge, this company is currently or about to do this, and that's not good, and you need to tell them to stop. So what happened was when the FTC first sued Niora, the FTC thought they had all of this authority to, you know, shut them down, to freeze their assets, to do all kinds of different things that they had been doing for 40 years to different companies, both MLM and non-MLM, by the way. And so they were under that sort of pretense that they had that authority, even though the Supreme Court said, no, you don't. But that was later on. So what happened when the Supreme Court said, and maybe even before the Supreme Court decision came out, Niora changed their tune, okay? Niora cleaned up their act. So by the time it went to trial, which, again, takes years, and that's normal, unless you're Donald Trump, then that has to happen tomorrow. I won't get too political here. But anyway, it normally takes years to go through this process to get to trial. So by the time it got to trial, then this 9-0 decision had been made by the Supreme Court, and all of the things that Niora had been doing were off the table. The judge had to look, because of the Supreme Court decision, only at Niora's current and future behavior, you know, what they were about to do and what they were currently doing. So all that stuff they were doing wrong in the past was no longer a topic. It was no longer part of the lawsuit. And so Niora was able to escape, so to speak, and say, oh, no, we're not doing that right now, and we're not about to do it. So you can't do anything to us. And by law, they were right. But it was only because of the lucky timing that they had with the Supreme Court decision. So it wasn't because Niora was goody two-shoes. It was because they had the timing to where they could clean up their act, and then the FTC was powerless, essentially. Now, another major thing with the Niora case, and this came up with Peter Vandernat's presentation, where he has in the past, Peter Vandernat, he's a retired economist with the FTC and also previous to that, a college professor and an economist, you know, by training. He wrote an article, I think it was in PINA.org a few years ago, where he said, over time, I've become convinced of the primacy of retail sales. In other words, retail sales is where it's at, which I've been saying for years myself. And he got on this last MLMconference.com. The presentation should be available pretty soon. I haven't checked recently. Maybe they're out there now. But they should be available pretty soon if they're not already. And his presentation was about how Niora, or I should say how the FTC was cheated by Niora. And even before the show, on this show, I made the comment that, you know, this is really interesting because he's been talking about the primacy, the importance, you know, that the most important thing is retail sales. And now he's going to get on this conference and talk about how he thinks the FTC was cheated in this lawsuit. And what he basically said, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, or Peter, what he basically said was Niora didn't have hardly any retail sales, and they should have been asked to prove that they did, and the onus should not have been on the FTC to prove that they did not have retail sales. Now, it's pretty well understood in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty. And so just by that generic reasoning, that's a really stupid, I'll call it stupid, comment to make, that NIORA is supposed to prove that they have retail sales versus the FTC proving that they don't. Now, it gets even more fundamental than that, because for the past, I don't know how long, 3 or 4 years, and we don't talk about it every week, but anytime it came up for the past 3 or 4 years, I've been perplexed, and I think Peter has been, because the FTC was saying NIORA has 1% retail sales. And NIORA has pushed back and said, no, we have 70 or 80% retail sales. Well, both of those cannot be true, right? They're so far apart. And we had no idea what was going on until this decision came out. And what happened was the FTC interpreted when NIORA sold products at full retail price, NIORA labeled that as a retail sale. Only 1% of the people chose to be a customer under the full retail price. Everyone else chose to be a preferred customer that got a discount. They may have paid, I don't know, $20 a year, but just like you would at Costco or Sam's Club or BJ's, whatever your, you know, warehouse type store is in your country or your part of the country, and they got a discount on the products, and you could buy just a few products and make up that whatever it is, $20 a year, whatever it is in membership fee, and then you would be saving money after that. And that is a customer. Okay, that's a customer. But the FTC, including Peter Vandernat, which I'm really surprised with his background, that he did not consider those preferred customers as retail customers. And he was fundamentally wrong, and so was Stacey Bosley. She didn't bring that up. The FTC, nobody in the FTC brought that up. And that's why it was such a slam dunk on the retail sales issue. And when I saw that decision, I'm like, well, this explains the difference, is the FTC is incompetent. They do not know what a retail sale is. And it was just amazing to me that they made such a fundamental error. And then Peter Vandernat jumped on top of that and in my opinion made a fool of himself in that conference with that presentation. It was just unbelievable to me that this is our government protecting us in quotes, right? Totally incompetent. And you know, it's just amazing to me that this is where we're at after half a century of you know, MLM litigation, that these fundamental mistakes are still being made by the agency that's supposed to be regulating MLM, you know, by and large. The SEC sometimes gets a little bit involved, so does the DOJ, but the primary responsibility in MLM regulations is the FTC. So I'll give it back to you, Dave, but that was something we've talked about on the show before. And it just is remarkable to me how the FTC just flubbed that up completely, that aspect in particular.
I think, and I have to rely on your recollection of the conference versus my own, because for me it was 2 or 3 a.m. when Peter gave his presentation. So my cognitive ability to follow all of his presentation is in question. So I'll have to watch his video when it comes out again to be sure. But my understanding when he started is he really wanted to focus on that aspect of the discount. And he began with that, I think, with the understanding or notion that how can you argue for free market operations if most of your products are only being sold through a discount? Is there true market demand for your product if the only price associated with your product is that discounted price that requires some enrollment in a program? Now, it is true there are, as you were listing, some other retail outlets that require memberships to be able to purchase products. At least that's how Costco works. We don't have Sam's Club in Canada, and it hasn't really expanded elsewhere. But to my knowledge, you don't have like 98% of your consumer market or 99% of your consumer market that's enrolled in those member programs. I don't know if that impacts it at all, but my sense of what Peter was trying to sort of drive at is, if we are really talking about retail sales, the products themselves should exist for, there should be demand that exists for them within the realm outside of the discount.
Yeah, I mean, I look at non-MLM businesses, and my personal opinion, and I'm just talking generically here, whether it's MLM or non-MLM, I think there should be some kind of a law that says you have to offer your products at least 50% of the time at full retail price, because there's lots of places that advertise products that are on sale constantly or nearly constantly. I mean, that is so common across the whole market, not just MLMs, but across the whole market, that it seems like everything is always on sale. And to me, that's just marketing. Okay, there's no law that I'm just describing as far as 50% of the time it has to be full retail price. But I look at that as just marketing. You know, you're saying, hey, here's the retail price, and here's the good deal I'm offering you. And what it really comes down to is, whatever the deal is, whether it's the full retail price or the discount, the customer is still making a decision. Is this worth that amount? Yes or no? And even at the discount price, most people say no. And so I look at it as kind of a moot point. It's more important to look at the actual dollar figure and whether those products are actually being purchased versus trying to play that marketing game between full retail price and, you know, the sale price, so to speak, the discount. I just see that as marketing. I don't see that as a major issue.
But in those marketing drives, most regular businesses are not looking to pay a distributor network of 100,000 people. They're usually, like, it goes into their coffers and then they distribute it to their employees. I think the other half of this coin is when you are offering everything on the discount, it's really undercutting the retail sales profit that your independent contractors can make within the force. So they are then further reliant on the reward scheme that is at play with the business side, as opposed to the actual sales of those products to consumers who want the products themselves.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just see that full retail price as, you know, something that makes the discount look better, right? If you just put the discount there as the full retail price, then people say, well, that's pretty expensive. Whereas if you put the full retail price and you say, but you can get this discount, again, it's psychology marketing. And you know, that's what marketing is psychology. And so I hear what you're saying. But to me, the full retail price is just that shiny object that is never really intended to be used, right? Now, 1% were using it. You know, maybe some of those customers only saw one product that they were interested in, and so it made more sense for them, tail customer, because they wouldn't make up the membership fee with buying that product over the course of a year, let's say. That would be a reason for someone to do that, or maybe they just wanted to try out a product and see how it goes, and maybe then some of them became preferred customers and got the discount. Those two things would explain, you know, or would be examples of explaining why it's 1%. But to me, someone who's not the distributor, who doesn't sign a distributor contract, is a customer. And I know I wrote in my May 2022 input to the FTC, which I encourage everyone to read, by the way. It's on my Facebook page. It's the first story on my Facebook page. If you go to facebook.com/ScottTexJohnson, it's ScottTexJohnson, all one word. It's the top story on my Facebook page
And I go into some detail on that whole subject of retail and, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's full retail price or not. And but to me, again, do you have sales? Is it half of your demand or more to show that you have free market demand? I don't really care about the price even, because if you think about it, an MLM product that has poor quality, it could be priced similar to a store or even less than a store. But if it's really bad quality, then again, the free market will determine whether there's a demand for it. You might be able to sell a couple of them for a short period of time, but over time and lots of people, it just won't be sold very, very commonly. And so, again, the free market, even if it's priced less than a competing item, but it's poor quality, it ain't going to sell. And so even price is a non-factor when you think about it that way. The real question is, are at least 50% of the sales going to customers? If they are, great. If they're not, that's a big warning flag as far as it being an illegal pyramid. And it's unfortunate that the FTC does not think that they need to get specific, because the industry has asked for it. You know, the MLMs have said, we want better guidance. We want more specifics that we can operate under. And so now another part of this, Dave, is what do you do? I'm going Amway on you again here. I don't know what other MLMs do specifically, but in Amway, if a distributor, if an IBO does not have 50 PV of retail sales on a monthly basis for any given month, and that's about $150, by the way, maybe going towards 200 now. So they have to have at least 10 customers or 50 PV of retail sales to earn their downline volume bonus. Okay. That's how, you know, you are eligible to receive your downline volume bonus. So if you have even a small group of, let's say 10, where you make most of your money from, not from your own purchases. So you have a big incentive to have that 50 PV, which hardly anyone does, by the way. Amway just ignores the rule. And so what's happening is if you don't have that 50 PV, then that bonus that you would have received goes to your upline. Well, I think that that should be changed. I think that that bonus should go back to the company. It should go back to Amway, because the distributor's upline is responsible for teaching them how to do the business correctly, which includes retail sales. So you don't want to reward the upline for not doing their job in teaching the downline on how to do retail sales. And so you should send that money back to the company. And you say, oh, that's not fair. The company makes all the money. Well, guess what's going to happen? When that upline doesn't get that downline's bonus, they're not going to be making any money, and they're going to quit. So not only is the downline going to quit, but the upline is going to quit. The whole thing is going to fall apart. And I think that's a really good change that should be made, is the upline should not be rewarded for not doing their job. You should line up the incentives properly so that you do get the retail sales. Now, you also have to be very careful because these people like to cheat. So you can't just assume that these are legitimate retail sales. They cheat. And we've heard that from a lot of different MLMs, not just Amway. They make up people. They sell things to their pets or their, you know, they might sell something to their neighbor or relative, you know, use their name, their address, their telephone number, their email, their credit card. And then they go over there and pick up the products and give them a check. And it's just a fake customer. And those things can be found out. You know, those things can be discovered, and you know, you can find the cheaters. That can be done. So anyway, those are just some more of my thoughts on retail sales and how to properly account for what's going on. And by the way, I think if you had 50% retail sales requirement, almost every MLM will either do what AdvoCare did in 2019 and go to direct sales, right? There's no upline, there's no downline. It's all, every distributor is connected directly to the MLM company, and your income is what you sell to customers, period. Or they're going to go out of business. I think most MLMs, one of those two things would happen with a 50% retail requirement that's enforced and checked for cheating. And then, you know, all these anti-MLMers, these fervent, rabid anti-MLMers that just want MLM to go away for no reason because it's terrible, but there's no legal reason, guess what? It's almost exactly the same outcome. But now you have a process to get there. And it's unbelievable to me that the anti-MLMers just think they can snap their fingers and it's going to go away because they demand it, because they are them. And that's not how things work. So it's frustrating. But I think you need a process. You need reasons. You need logic. You need things you can measure to make something happen. You can't just say, I'm mad and it should go away. And there's nothing to it other than you being mad. And that's the big problem I have with, not you, Dave, but most anti-MLMers out there. They have no reasons. They're just mad, and it should just go away because they're mad. So I'll stop there. I could keep going forever. I'll let you comment on all that, too.
I do know. Sure. I do know that you did speak to this, I think, in a previous radio show. It's just the point that Tina made at the end of the conference is pushing for a day on the Hill. Because the DSA obviously gets their day where they get to speak with the lawmakers. It would be nice to have some of the people who have come out of MLM have that chance to sort of talk about some of the problems they've experienced and speak directly to this, right? There should be some sort of law that's imposed that helps to make sure that this kind of exploitation or whatever you want to call it is not happening among all of these MLMs. And it could be mitigated if there are retail sales requirement and you remove the incentive to create some sort of business development program or tools program that helped to keep people inside the business thinking that it was just their fault that they weren't making what they needed to, and then not reporting the money that upper level people are making from that business. I think there definitely does need to be that chance to speak to, if it's not even all the lawmakers in the legislative branch in the U.S., it's their policy people, just to begin that conversation, because it doesn't seem to be happening at all.
I wonder how many people have taken Tina.org up on their idea. I'm planning on contacting them. I've been waiting just to ask Tina.org the question, how many people took you up on going up to Capitol Hill and doing, you know, what the DSA does on an annual basis. Because I know that, and this probably will not be in the recordings because it was not a presentation, but I do know that when that question came up and Bill Keith was kind of leading the discussion at the time, you know, that people said, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And Tina.org came up with that idea, which I think is a good one. But then Bill Keith said, well, I'm going to go back to writing my papers, and I assume you're going to go back to, you know, doing your YouTube anti-MLM videos, and see you next year. And that was very disappointing to hear that, you know, he's not really interested in, you know, ramping things up. And, hey, see you in a year was basically the message. I'm not going to do anything, and I don't know if anyone has contacted Tina.org. You know, to participate this fall up there at Capitol Hill. But it was a real downer to me when that happened. Mm-hmm. There was just nothing coming out of the conference, you know, of any substance except people.
Yeah.
And that was another big thing that I have a problem with is there was no real open discussion, right? It was all people looking at the camera, giving their 2 cents, but there was no bouncing of ideas around like we do on the show all the time when we have guests. You know, we say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And you know, you can add to the conversation. You can do like what Peter was doing earlier. You know, why is the FTC not coming up with a 50% criteria? Why is it they think that that's overstepping their bounds when they, for four decades, were taking people to court when they had no authority to do that? You know, it was just, yeah. Well, I shouldn't say taking the court. They were going beyond, you know, doing what they were authorized to do. They were going way beyond it. But they can't seem to say, well, 50% is a good starting point, you know. And by the way, in my May 2022 write-up, I said, not only is it should be 50%, but it should be 50% of everything. In other words, if an MLM charges somebody to join the MLM, then that should be offset with retail sales as well. That's going to incentivize MLMs to not charge anything to join the MLM, just like is required in the UK. And for the first year in Amway now, there's no charge to join the MLM. That would bring the joining and renewal fees down. The tool scams, if you make $1 million on tools, then guess what? Your organization needs to have $1 million more of retail sales. And you'll see those tool prices come down, I guarantee it. So that's part of my 50% is it's got to be 50% of the whole picture. Because if you don't do that, it's not going to be meaningful. And that's in my May of 2022 write-up. I encourage people to you know, to read that because that's important to understand where I'm coming from. It's not just 50% and the MLM can take advantage of it. It is comprehensive. So back to you guys.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's also being done with regards to the Tina suggestion, I know some of the social media activists, they're looking at doing town halls, which I guess is a good first step. It's giving that open forum, that platform to have those discussions because you're trying to find, I mean, ultimately one of the goals of that is finding the people that are the right people to invite onto the Hill on a day. Obviously, everyone would be invited, but it would be something that you would want to target key people that could speak to lawmakers because you can't invite everyone's story onto the stage on that day, right? You kind of need to find the ones that kind of speak to the more general concerns and can also articulate the issues that are relevant for laws. Because I know you've talked about before, you can't really focus on the emotional cult stuff for lawmakers to really care about because there is no coercive control legislation in the U.S. and there's probably no space to go in that area. So you kind of have to focus on the key metrics that you're talking about is the retail sales and tool scams.
Yeah, those are things that are measurable, right? You can measure retail sales.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to measure the emotional stuff. I'm not saying it's not true. In fact, for many people, it might be the most significant thing of their experience. And I'm not discounting that at all. I'm just saying there's no laws against it. It's hard to measure. And if you go there, you're setting yourself up to fail. I'm trying to win, right? And I'm not sure if everybody would be invited, Dave, because I've been disinvited to the MLM conference. And I'm not disappointed, by the way, because, you know, when people like Bill Keep and Stacey Bosley are there, I don't want to be associated with those people because of the things we've been talking about. I don't have any disappointment in not being invited to the MLM conference, the MLMconference.com last 4 years. And I told Bill Keep that in writing, by the way, because he pretty much told me, well, you're not invited. Well, maybe I don't even want to be invited. So that's where we're at. I mean, it's really unbelievable how an adult, supposedly, and a college professor on top of that, you know, someone who's in academia should be looking for people with different viewpoints. And he's all in on the anti-MLM HUN stuff. And it's really amazing to me how close-minded an academic type person is. Now, you know, I'm 65 years old, so I'm speaking of my own academic timeline. I know that academics now is not what it used to be. It's gotten much more closed-minded than it was 40 years ago. That's just the reality. And it's unfortunate because academia is supposed to be exploring and open, you know, to new ideas, to new points of view, so you can really hash things out. Unfortunately, academia is not that anymore. And that's just the facts. It's unfortunate. But that's our world that we have to live in. We have to accept reality. So anyway, right. I'll hand it back to you and Peter.
I will hand it off to Peter in a moment because I think Peter probably has a couple of things to weigh in on this because I'm sure he sees mentioned. The one last thing that I want to touch on is just at the conference, you have this mix of people that have obviously different interests in mind, right? An academic needs to sort of be seen as someone who is relying on the data in order to drive their decisions, and they're not necessarily injecting their personal bias into it. A social media activist is basically mostly relying on personal bias, but is trying to, especially in that conference setting, elevate to a point where they're relying not only on their own experiences, but the experiences of others. And then you also have the lawmakers that obviously need to have an even more objective lens on everything and can't be seen showing sort of partiality for things. And then you have people who have an axe to grind, whether that be Julie Anderson or Marco, with the people that are in that room and feeling upset with what's not being accomplished at the legislative level. And then as much as the DSA probably has a number of different people from different areas of industry within the ML marketplace kind of competing for certain interests themselves, I think that there's much more diversity and areas of conflict or difference of opinions or needing to speak on behalf of your area of expertise within the kind of space that's trying to protect consumers. There's much more area there for conflict. And then even in your case, not being able to speak on the basis of different reasons in terms of finding agreement with others. I know that you've hashed out some of the situations that have taken place on social media before that have kind of distanced you from others, and then also the frustration you have with working with those people that are in the content space. So I think that we're not going to find the best way to get onto the Hill with that mix of people. But hopefully there does come a day where a number of individuals are able to speak to lawmakers and hopefully push this forward. Because Jason Jones is right. The only way that we see a big change happen within this place is if the laws change.
Yeah, and good luck with that, because our Congress is – I mean, they can't even pass important legislation, you know, of national significance. MLM is really tiny compared to some of the other issues that Congress is not able to deal with. Significant as it is, it's much smaller than, you know, a lot of things, you know, a lot of national, international issues. So I just don't have any hope for the laws changing. I'll just say it very, very bluntly. And when you bring up Julie Anderson and Marco, both of those are Canadians. I don't think I heard one single reference to the Canadian regulators. It was all to the FTC. And it would have been nice for them to direct at least some of their energy towards the Canadian regulators versus focusing exclusively on the FTC. I thought that was a little weird that they were so upset at another country's regulators, and not a word was said about their own regulators, which, by the way, if you listen to year one of the MLMconference.com, I believe there was a Canadian regulator there, and I did submit a written question two questions. One of them was regarding retail sales, and I believe the Canadian regulator who was there, the question was basically, do you consider that an important issue in MLM? And all of the regulators except for the U.S. said, no, we have no – that's no importance to us, the amount of retail sales. which really did floor me. I was like, wow, you guys really don't understand it. Now, the U.S. guy, who's now in private practice, of course, kind of danced around it. You know, he kind of said it was important, but he didn't really say much. You know, he's really good at talking without saying anything meaningful like a lot of politicians are. But it was interesting that no other countries, at least that were there, thought that retail sales was anywhere on their radar as far as importance when they're looking at an MLM, which floored me, as you know, Dave. But that's, you know, I agree with Peter Vandernat from the standpoint that retail sales is the most important thing, except for tool scams when they're present. So, yeah, it's we have a long ways to go. There's no doubt. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
Peter, did you have any other?
Good. Unfortunately, Canada just isn't really well equipped. Canada is not very well equipped to deal with MLMs. A lot of the laws that are in place for the Competition Bureau just are not really something that you'll see them ever really bring a case against a company. And in the reality, most of those companies are based in the U.S. There's a handful of Canadian operations that started in Canada, but the reality of it is that they might hold an office on Bay Street in Toronto. Just sort of have their Canadian headquarters there. But for the most part, it's American-based businesses. So I think Julie and Marco are likely approaching it from that angle of, in order for us to stop the problems in Canada, we have to kind of address the issues that are happening in the U.S. Obviously, they grow at a number of people that have bad experiences with MLMs. And if their main point of what you can do is report to the FTC and they don't see anything happen from that, I think that that's where you're getting that kind of outrage from their point of view.
Yeah, but I mean, Canada could kick them out of the country just like the UK regulators almost did with Amway. Now, the U.S. companies have no problem suing people like Marco and Julie Anderson, even though they're based in the United States, and those guys are Canadians. So, you know, to me, you know, it's fair game. It should be. To complain about your own regulators. I'm not saying don't complain to the FTC. I'm just saying you guys have regulators too. You should be complaining about them on top of the FTC. To me, that's only fair, you know, to complain about the regulators in your own country as well as the United States. So that's kind of where I come from. Mm-hmm. Peter, did you have anything else? Or this has flown by again. With Dave,
so
much more we could talk about.
Yep. Well, we have to have Dave back, and I'm going to just bring up one point, and it's the academics. So I'm going to pick on the academics by picking on the academics with a short story. So the academics are good at massaging and studying the data. And as an outsider looking in and knows a lot about the inside, I always question the data that they sit there and worship and study, including the stuff that they see in the income disclosures. So to use as an example that does not fit, but I know Dave's a teacher, so I'm going to try to give our Building Fortunes Radio listening audience a teacher example. So imagine Dave's a teacher, and he's got all of his papers on the desk, and he's got to leave because maybe there's a fire alarm. So we're talking about like traditional classrooms, fire alarm, oh, got to leave. And then when he comes back in, what he didn't realize is that the kindergartners came into his classroom and then messed up all the papers, threw them all over the floor, and then the janitor wound up putting them in the garbage because he cleans up stuff after they're done. And this happened with all of the classrooms, so we have like, oh, shoot, all of the teachers had all of the papers smushed all over the place by all of the kindergartners, and the conscientious janitor wind up putting them all in the trash pail, and then all of a sudden Dave's got a deadline, and the principals come in, and they say, give us your papers. And he's like, I can't give you the papers. I asked the janitor. They're all mixed up. I don't, like, oh, my gosh. I can't, this is all wrong. This is all wrong. And they say, give me the papers anyway. And then the academics sit there in a different building and they study and massage and whatever, formulate all of their hoity-toity things based on those documents that were, let's face it, absolutely, positively worthless as far as accuracy is concerned. And that's the way I look at the way the academics use the income disclosures and the way the academics use some of the other statistics in this industry. I have no problem with statistics and measurement and data and all that sort of stuff. I have to use it for my own business. But their data is flawed, and I would love to be able to have a sincere conversation with lots of people about what I just said about show me how the data that you are determining all of your arguments on is accurate. And the answer is it's not. So all of the people that go out there and quote income disclosures, the Marcos, the CC Suarez, the Savannah Maries, the Aaron B's, the Julie Andersons, the this gal, the that gal, the Platinums. What is the latest one? The Platinum Chelsea, I think it is, whatever her name or his name is, whatever it is. This is a mess. You people, not Dave, are using, like, data that is obviously flawed, and somebody that was watching the whole event, so I'm bringing you back. I was sitting there, watch, the fire alarm went off, Dave had to leave, kindergartners came in, they mushed up everything. The janitor swept it up because that's what janitors do. Dave gets yelled at. You got to give me some results. He's like, this, I don't, okay. And then the principals are sitting there, you know, trying to get their grants or whatever they're doing based on the flawed data. It's just ridiculous. So that's where conversation would fly.
To add to that, sometimes their data is perfect, but then they misinterpret it. Let me give an example. Bill Keep has been saying for, I don't know, at least 2 or 3 years, I think, if you look at the amount of money that an MLM gives to the politicians as a percentage of their revenue compared to the percentage of the revenue of, let's say, Facebook, that it's much higher. And he tries to use that to explain why MLMs have so much influence over politicians. But if you look at the actual dollars being given, Facebook, for example, gives many, many, many more times the amount of money to politicians than, let's say, an Amway does, because they're so much bigger of a business. It's a smaller percentage of their revenue, but it's a lot more in terms of dollars. Well, Bill Keep tries to explain that as that's why MLMs have so much influence over politicians. And I just don't agree with that because, you know, politicians go where the money goes. And it doesn't matter what your revenue is. I mean, that shows how much important it is to Amway, for example, that they give a higher percentage of their own revenue. But that's not going to change a politician's view of how much they're going to be influenced. And that's where I think a lot of anti-MLMers really are faking themselves out by thinking that, you know, these companies, these MLMs are giving a lot of money to politicians, and they are. But the way it works is if we start working together and we come up with money as a group, we can overcome that. So, you know, going to Capitol Hill is great. So is getting organized and putting our money together you know, influencing the politicians, because that's how you influence politicians. It's with money. You can have a great story, but if you don't have some money, you're not even going to get the door opened. So that's just the way it works. I don't make up the rules. I'm just telling you how it works. And as long as we don't keep working together and we don't put our funds together, we're going to keep going down this road, I believe. So I just sound pessimistic. I'm really optimistic. If people would just work together, we could be successful. But, you know, and I'm not talking to Dave here, but you got to put your ego aside and understand what you want. Do you want to make YouTube videos and make a few bucks? or do you want to shut down a massive scam? It's up to you. And that's, you know, that's where I come from. I want to win. And, but it's going to have to mean people are going to have to work together. And so anyway, I'll stop there. Dave, I'll let you make any final comments and we'll get back together next Saturday, Peter.
Okay.
Sure.
Go ahead, Dave.
I'm sorry to drag this out a little bit longer. I do want to just comment
You're
on
okay.
the assumptions piece, which I think, Peter, I think is a good one to raise. And I think that the academics could definitely benefit from hearing from more of your area as well as any other people who would be interested in challenging the assumptions that a lot of the MLMs are applying or even what the FTC is telling the academics to use in revealing the case. One instance, especially on the percentage of money that's spent on lobbying that I think is important that I don't know if Bill necessarily fully articulates, but it's really the assumption that all businesses should have the same incentives in order to spend their budgets according to what they would put into lobbying. And I think what he's trying to show with his numbers is he's showing that there is an outsized percentage within MLM corporate teams to spend money on their interests in lobbying versus other big areas that would also have large interests in lobbying, but it's contributing a much more less significant portion of their overall budget for that. So his assumption that he's trying to sort of lead with is all businesses should have the same incentive, but MLMs have a larger incentive than others, which suggests that perhaps there is some sort of existence. I for one, don't really think that lobbying happens at the grand scale, but a lot of people will argue. I think it happens at the margins. Like it can matter for small things. It's not going to matter for the entire legitimacy of MLM. It's not stopping laws from being created. That's just simply the business market of the U.S. wanting to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to start their own business. You don't want to start imposing barriers that would prevent them from doing so. So I don't think that's lobbying. I think that's just sort of the ethos of the business climate in the U.S.
Yeah, well, another point is, you know, the FTC has no problem going after massive companies. You know, they've gone after Google, Facebook, you know, you name it. Companies that are much larger than any MLM or all MLMs put together. So another, again, common refrain from the anti-MLMers is that the FTC is afraid to go after them, you know, because they're so big and because they give so much money to the politicians that they, being the FTC, are unable to go after because of the constraints of the legislative branch telling the FTC, now don't go after this MLM because they gave me a bunch of money. It's just ridiculous in my mind. And even if it is happening, it can be overcome. You know, if we get organized and we put our money together and we put our thoughts together and we go after this in an organized manner, we can be successful. But it's going to take people to wise up. And if they don't, it's going to keep doing what it's doing. So anyway, I didn't let you get your last word in there, Dave. If you had anything more to add to that, go right ahead.
That's all I got for this week. Thank you very much to you both, Peter and Scott, for inviting me back.
Great job, David. Thank you.
Okay.
So, Scott, I'll let you wrap it up, and then we'll close it out.
Okay. Well, I wanted to thank Dave again because, again, this is a good – you know, back and forth discussion where we explore different points of view. And that's important because that's where learning occurs. You know, I try to do a lot of reading on a lot of different things. And in fact, I read the AdvoCare stuff this past week, which was amazing. I didn't know this, I don't think, before. AdvoCare, just as an example, AdvoCare, before they you know, basically got shut down. They didn't get completely shut down. They're still in business as a direct selling company. But what they were doing was, let's say a distributor made $100 in 1 month and no other money for the other 11 months. AdvoCare would take that 1 month and multiply it by 12 and say this was their annual income. They were completely cooking the books. So that's the kind of stuff that's out there. If you go and research and understand why AdvoCare was essentially shut down, at least as an MLM, that explains a lot. You know, when you do that kind of reading and research, you come across those things that are just amazing. So anyway, we'll be back next Saturday. I'm trying to remember. I think my brother is going to be on next Saturday, Peter. And that's going to be a good meeting, a good podcast, because we'll talk about it during the podcast, but it should be an interesting podcast, and we'll talk to you next Saturday. And Dave, thanks again.
And Scott, one more time on your website.
Yes, my Facebook page, where you'll find three websites, my YouTube link, a video on there from Vimeo. I think there's a Rumble link, my email, my phone number. I'm easy to get a hold of. No excuse for not being able to contact me. It's facebook.com/ScottTexJohnson, ScottTexJohnson, all one word. And again, thanks, Peter. Thanks, Dave. See you next week.
See you, everyone. Thanks. Thanks, David.
You've been listening to Building Fortunes Radio on buildingfortunesradio.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the designated Building Fortunes Radio segment with Peter Mingle. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website for our featured segments. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. At Building Fortunes Radio, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.